I guess my driver isn't to be selected. My driver's to be the best I can be, and if I can get in that squad for then, brilliant. If I can't, that's my journey. I think the big thing for me is kind of, I don't just want to be selected and then stop. I think that's quite a dangerous place to be mentally when you're, when all you're caring about is just being selected. Like, for example, like I really struggle with people who just want to be there. So for example, like people who just want to be in the GB squad, like they're just happy being in the GB squad. Like for me, that's not a thing. I really struggle with that mindset of like, it's a job. Well, it's not a job. Like if you're in this, you want to be the best that you can be. Or you want to win stuff. Like I get that driver. I don't get the, oh, I'm just happy to be there type thing.
Learning about yourself in early adulthood is a process we all go through, but imagine having to do so whilst representing your country. Indeed, many athletes undergo this process and often learn valuable life lessons in highly pressurised situations where you really do have to grow up quickly. One person in particular who has discovered a lot about himself since first representing his country in 2017 is England and GB hockey star Brendan Creed. Through working closely with his team psychologist, as well as having to deal with tournament disappointments, being named as a reserve for 2 World Cups, coping with injuries and more, Brendan has not only changed his opinion on the topic of psychology, but also his outlook on himself and his sport. His passion for hockey, though, has never wavered. In a wide-ranging interview, we speak about why representing his country will never just be a job for him, his drive to be the best he can be, how he thinks hockey can better sell itself to the general public, and why he set up the Let's Stick Together podcast with teammates Phil Roper.
Welcome back, listeners, to another episode in our latest series of Sportspiel. And I'm delighted to say that today's guest is someone I've been fortunate enough to work with for several years and know very well. It's been a little while since I left him in the world of hockey. But Brendan, great to see you and thank you for coming on the podcast.
No, thank you. I don't know if fortunate's the right word, but yeah, we'll see.
It was always fun. It was always fun, even when you were ringing me up, challenging why I put something out on the social media.
It was only through love. It was only through love.
It was always appreciated. Brendan, so much to ask you. A lot has happened since we last saw each other, but I guess I actually want to start by looking ahead. We're in early 2023 as we record. A lot to come up over the next 18 months, Pro League, European Championships, ultimately an Olympics. How are you feeling ahead of what's going to be a very busy, hopefully busy time for you?
Oof, big question. I'm really excited, to be honest. There's so, as you say, Pro League's actually changed format this year, which I think has been brilliant for personally. I think a few people are unsure about it, but I actually really like what they've done this year. It's just made it a bit more, there's more on the games, which I think is exciting. Obviously, Europeans is the best thing in terms of, it's the biggest European competition we've got. I also have really fond memories of the Euros. I've always had really, really enjoyable tournaments from the three that I've been to so far. Then obviously Paris in a year's time is massive. Just got to fight my way back into the scene. That's my next game. That's my next effort. It's been a pretty whirlwind few years, and there's so many things coming up that actually there's no time to rest. It's all go, 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 which is, I think, the unique thing about hockey is that it's fully all year round if you're playing the international stuff. So it's busy.
You mentioned there Paris coming up, and it feels like the previous Olympics has only just happened from my perspective. Like, how is that being sort of with that mindset, obviously you've done, your first Olympic cycle was extended because of COVID, and now you've come into a shorter one. So how have you found getting your head around that?
Yeah, I think I actually think the transition's been pretty seamless. I think the year that we had after Tokyo was quite quiet for predominantly 6-7 months, which I actually think they played really well as staff members. I think they're really sensible with that, which then meant that actually people could recuperate and go again. So I think the 5 years doesn't feel like 5 years because we lost a year anyway through COVID. Whereas this 3 years definitely feels like a 3 years. But that's not a negative thing because I think a 3-year cycle is actually really exciting for us as a group. So I think there's not really been a case of it's felt too much. I think it's just felt very full on, but to be expected. So from that point of view, actually, it's not been bad. It's just been quick, it's been really quick, really fast, really intense, and kind of you have to either get on board with it or you're caught lagging, really.
Where do you think the squad is at the moment? Obviously, you've only just played your first games as GB in this programme a couple of months ago, but there were some impressive performances that you put in. It's currently top of the Pro League as we record, so yeah, just interested to think where you think the squad is at the moment and how excited you are for the next 18 months.
I think the group's in probably the best place it's been in for a fair few years. Now change of head coach, now all coaches, support staff, everything's set up now, which is quite exciting because there's been a lot of change over the past 2 years for the group. I think it's actually in a really, really good place to go and do something really special. And I think the interesting thing is from the outside, what might look like special to us is expected. And I think that's the pressure we only place on ourselves compared to probably what the general public think and what people around the world probably think. Coming off the back of a disappointing World Cup in terms of finishing place, but in terms of how we played, it's exactly what we wanted. So from that point of view, the group's also playing well on the big stage, minus 3 minutes from a World Cup quarterfinal. Everything else up to that point was pretty spectacular. And it's just making sure that we can continue that for the remainder of a game, not just the first 57 minutes. So from that point of view, the group's in a great place. It's just a case of where we go with it now.
You mentioned the World Cup there, and you've alluded to it previously. Obviously, you guys are playing as England, not GB, so not everybody was involved. But one of the people that unfortunately wasn't involved was yourself. I guess the second World Cup where you've been named as a reserve. Just I was wondering if you were able to talk us through how that felt and you know how you were able to deal with that disappointment, really.
Yeah, at the end of the day, I'm gutted. 30 years old and not playing in the World Cup is not exactly where you want to be in your career. But at the same time, like I completely respect the coach's decision. I questioned it a lot, but not through anything other than what's the best way for me to get better as a player. So from that point of view, I kind of had to respect the decision. It is what it is. I can't change his mind. The big thing was just making sure that, one, if somebody did get injured, I was there ready to go as one of them travelling reserves. But also just making sure that I'm still working on what I want to work on. Like, my journey's not finished. And it's just making sure that, like I did 4 years ago, it's just making sure I can kind of get myself into a position where I'm back in the team and offering what I can to the group. So from that point of view, I've luckily been in this situation before, but also unluckily been in this situation before, so quite unique. But at the same time, I didn't go to the last World Cup and I went to the last Olympics. It's making sure I follow that similar path in terms of making sure I get back into the squad. So yeah, you can be down about it, but there's no point sulking about it because you don't really get anything out of it. And the other thing was I didn't really want to ruin anybody else's experience. Mm-hmm. That for me was kind of a big thing. Last time I flew out late, so it was quite easy for me to kind of mix into the group quite easily at the last World Cup. I came in with 10 days to go. It was a fresh person, fresh face, and kind of it was quite easy. Whereas this one I felt was a little bit harder in terms of I was there for the full 26 days. But at the same time, like, I'm just trying to make sure that everybody else has a good time. They get the most out of it. They play the best they can. Because ultimately, I'd rather miss out on a team that wins a World Cup than miss out on a team that goes out and than be part of miss out on being in a team that gets knocked out in the quarterfinals. Mm-hmm. So from that point of view, it was always a case of trying to push the group as much as they can as well.
How did it feel watching on from the side, knowing that you couldn't go out and influence any of the games? Was that hard or was it?
Yeah, it's a really weird place to be as an athlete, especially in team sport, because you want the team to do well, but you also want to be involved. So it's kind of you're torn in terms of your personality on that side of things. I think the big thing comparison to last time to this time was that last time in the final two games, we lost 6-0 and 8-1, I believe. And that was quite painful because at the end of the day, I felt I could offer quite a lot. In this one, I didn't necessarily have a similar feeling as much because I actually thought the team played really, really well. So from that point of view, like, I don't see myself adding as much. So actually to watch this time was easier than last time. Don't get me wrong, heartbreak in the last 3 minutes of the quarterfinal this time, but last time in the semi-final in the third, fourth, kind of, it was one of the hardest things. I actually had an argument with one of my really good mates, Ropes, about it, Phil Roper. I had an argument with him last World Cup about it, because he was like, God, I was disappointed, humiliating, this, that, and the other, and I was like, yeah, mate, imagine being in the stands. And he was like, no, you don't get it. I was like, no, you don't get my side either. And it was kind of, we funnily enough, like, got to a point where both positions are horrible to be in, whether you're on the pitch or not. But yeah, it's definitely a lot easier this time than last time, but at the same time, it's still not the place you want to be.
Yeah, and I imagine it's even more gutting, as you say, when the team is being beaten heavily, or in the case of this time round, the late comeback from Germany in the shootout. Yeah, I guess from your perspective, watching that against Germany, how did you feel sort of seeing that unfold in front of you?
Yeah, I'll be honest, like, at the start of the game, I was struggling to watch it, and then by the end of it, me and Sloaner and the stands both, like, pulling hairs out with stressing, because it was one of those things where, like, you just naturally get behind, because you're used to being a team sport, you just get behind the guys. And it was tough to watch the final 3 minutes, because the classic, like, German hockey trait is the fact that they just seem to come back. I mean, this German group, whilst they may not have looked amazing all the way through the games, in the final three games they played, they came back from 2-0 down on three separate occasions. And the bit that was frustrating for us was the fact that when we were 2-0 up, we didn't capitalise on being 2-0 up. So from that point of view, there was a bit of frustration from us in the stands, for sure. I'm sure it was held by the guys down at the pitch as well. But yeah, it's just not the place you want to be when you're kind of watching everything unfold. It's pretty, yeah, you're just tearing hairs out because you want the guys to do well.
How disappointing was it for you as a squad as well? Because up until that point, as you mentioned, the first three games, the first 57 minutes of that game, the squad had looked one of the best in the tournament. People were sort of touting them for big things. And then it all sort of comes undone in 3 minutes of sort of German madness. How hard is that fit for you as a squad, considering how well you played up until that point?
I think it's really hard. I mean, there's not really much you can say on it. I think the frustration is the fact that whether or not it might have been our year, we felt like it was a really good opportunity to do something at a World Cup that an England side hasn't done for many years. So it feels a little bit of a missed opportunity, but at the same time, the group is so young, the majority of the group, that actually this might be just the first step in terms of this might be the massive learning curve that we need in terms of seeing games out that might, in a year's time or come 6 months, that might get us over the edge in terms of winning back and another medal, because it's been a while since we've won a medal outside of the Commonwealth Games. The last time was, what, 2017 Europeans?
Yeah.
It's the last time we've won a medal in a major competition outside of the commies. So from that point of view, I think it's going to be a brilliant learning curve, because there's still guys that are hurting now. And it's not necessarily a case of they're going to be hurting for years to come, but it's definitely, there's going to be lessons learned. I think that's a really good place to be for the group as well.
Obviously difficult for England, but one thing that massively encouraged me was what a spectacle the tournament was. The quality of the games, the results that were coming out, the stories that were being written. How good an advert for hockey was that World Cup, do you think?
Massive. Genuinely massive. I've never been in a stadium quite like Rockefeller. That was 21,000 packed to the rafters. Unique. But as you say, the tournament, whilst there are a few things that be questioned, I think the tournament was a genuine massive success. Should it be in India every year? Absolutely not. But at the same time, they did a really good job. And as you say, I think the beauty is the fact that the standard was so high. I think in 4 years ago, I don't necessarily think the standard was anywhere near as high as what it was this time. And again, that's testament to one, the groups, however, like the teams that have turned up. Like, I think it's just a massive testament to the whole tournament. But yeah, massive, massive for the sport.
And how important is it to see teams like, just teams that pop into my head, Korea, Malaysia, New Zealand, pulling off some big results against more fancied opposition? How important is that? Is their success for the growth of the sport?
Massive. I think, like, with New Zealand being one of the Pro League sides as well, I think that's really good. I think our trip's in April coming up for heading over there. I think it's massive for the smaller teams as such, like your Wales, your Chiles. It's teams like that that actually, like, just being on the stage with the bigger teams also helps massively just in terms of exposure. But as you say, like, when you've got Malaysia, Korea, New Zealand, the three teams that you wouldn't have necessarily suspected to be in the positions they were in, I think it's massive. I think it's really cool as well, because it just shows that there's not one unique way to, there's not one way to do it. It's unique for each nation, and I think that's what's quite encouraging about it all.
Yeah, it was certainly an exceptional tournament, but one thing that frustrated me, and this might be a frustration to you as well, is that if you were in the UK and you didn't follow or you didn't know the tournament was happening, in terms of you were a hockey fan, there was almost no coverage of it, barely anything on any national websites. I missed the Argentina-Korea game, which was 5-5-all. Yeah. I wanted to go and watch the full highlights of that on YouTube. There was like a 1-minute version put up, and that was it. How frustrating is that for you as a player, that you're part of something amazing and you want to help grow the sport, but there's no exposure?
Yeah, it's the problem with the middle-class sport. We just don't have the finances, facilities, the TV coverage to be able to give it free. What's frustrating is, I found out whilst we were out there, is that you can watch online in India for free. Whilst the tournament's in India, so you can obviously go and watch the game. I think the average price was £2 a ticket. You could go and watch a session of hockey for £2, or you can watch it for free online. But you can't in the UK, where we know the sport's not necessarily as successful as what it should be in terms of that TV coverage side of things. Yeah, you might get a game on BT, but who has BT subscription with the whole living cost crisis and everything else that's going on in the UK at the moment? Like, how are people going to afford to pay for BT when people are struggling to get meals on the table? So for me, it's kind of, there's a real opportunity there to get it on TV, get the exposure that it deserves. And I genuinely think it deserves it after this tournament. But as you say, the fact that you can't find it anywhere. BBC's not necessarily publicising it as much as other sports, which, again, I completely understand. We're a football country, we're a rugby country, like that. It's just how it is. I just wish we'd probably get a little bit more just in terms of like day-to-day coverage. But I think until we win anything or we do something special, no one's going to really take as much notice in the mainstream media, sadly. But there's definitely... That was one thing that confused me, was the fact that you could watch it live. You could watch it online for free in India, but you couldn't in the UK, which I find like mind-boggling.
But what's it actually like playing out in India? What's it like as an experience, and how different is it from playing anywhere else in the world?
It's, the fans are something that you don't really come across very often. They scream for nothing. So they'll scream out of the blue. You might have just won the ball on the edge of your own D. You might have had a counter-attack. The same noise comes out, and that's the bit that's madness. It's a shame, because if you play against India, you won't have a better atmosphere ever, but then you could play the next game and there could only be 200 people in the stadium because India aren't playing. So they're loyal fans, but it's also like, it is really cool when you play against them. And to silence an Indian crowd is something quite spectacular as well. So I can imagine the Kiwis had it in a ridiculous scenario where they beat them in the shootout, and kind of that stuff is like, that you won't ever have that experience of 15,000 people silenced. It's an insane place. Like, it's a crazy country. I could not recommend it more for people going to travel. Previously, I'd have said I don't like it. Whereas this tournament, genuinely, I have such a positive reflection of India. Phenomenal place, and the fans are just crazy. Whether it's cricket, whether it's hockey, like, it really is like a place for sport.
Interesting you say there, this was a positive experience, because I'm thinking back to one tournament in particular that was difficult, not just for you, not just for the England team, but for a number of different nations back in 2017. I was just wondering if you could talk us through a little bit about what happened.
Oh Lord. We had a mass breakout of E. coli. I think it was E. coli in the hotel. Anyway, it turns out that a third of the tournament players were ill. So there was a lot of diarrhea, a lot of throwing up. It was an awful, awful tournament to be involved in. I particularly had it quite bad at one stage. Didn't cover myself in glory, put it that way. It was a ridiculous... Whereas this one, we had no food poisoning, no nothing. So everything was fine. The only thing we had was smog problems. Whereas that 2017, the hotels weren't set up, the infrastructure wasn't there in the city for you to basically go and come away illness-free. Whereas now, because there's been so many tournaments there, it's now actually paid off, the fact that it's lasted that long, that hotels can now support full teams and there's no illness, there's no breakout of illness and anything like that. So I think from that point of view, yeah, it was a success this time, but 2017 was carnage. Yeah, it was bad. I think there were four of us that went for a walk around the hotel whilst game one was just about to start. We couldn't even get to the hotel. We couldn't even get to the pitch, sorry. We were walking around. I think one lap of the hotel, which was about a 5-minute walk, three of us had to run inside because it was getting too late already in terms of diarrhea. So that kind of like paints a picture of the state we were in. So game one, I think we had 14 players available. And then game two, I think we had 30. Like, it was one of those tournaments where it was crazy. The German second keeper had to start for Germany because they had 12 players available. Like, it was just...
Scored as well,
which is even crazier when you actually look back. It's actually ridiculous. But yeah, it was 2017. Yeah, bad year for hockey, that was.
Yeah, hockey's one of those sports where it has so many bizarre stories like that. And I just guess from your perspective, as a player playing at the top level in the sport, what does hockey need to do, in your opinion, to grow? And that's quite a loaded, potentially quite a broad question, but... No, to go outside of India and to keep attracting big crowds and getting people playing, what do you think hockey needs to do?
I think exposure. I think exposure is the big one. Like, if you look at Holland, you look at Belgium, two probably biggest hockey nations in Europe at the moment. Probably Belgium's probably overtaken Germany on that. It's on TV. So Thursday, Sunday at 3 PM, or 12 PM, sorry. So midday Sundays, there's a Belgian game on TV. Every Sunday at that time, men's game. Like, if you look at Dutch team, like, the Dutch coverage is just incredible. They've signed like a 3-year deal, I think, with the company they've been dealing with. And then you look at the UK and we don't have any domestic game on TV. The closest thing we have is Super Sixes on TV, and that's one day a year, which is a real disappointment because don't get me wrong, the indoor's like phenomenal and it's great that it's online, you can watch it, but you have to pay. Again, it's like from where it used to be, and granted, BBC used to put on and things like that, like it used to be really easy, but it's actually quite difficult to find hockey on TV these days unless you have BT subscription. And I think, like, if we really want to push it somewhere and we really want it to be more in your face and kind of everywhere else, you need to almost open up the TV rights to kind of give it an opportunity. I mean, if you look at the way netball did it, netball went to Sky. Sky basically said, what nights could you basically put netball on? They said Thursday nights. Bang, there you go. So they changed their league structure to make sure you could get the exposure. Now look at it. And sport's going absolutely mental. I know, funny enough, one of my friends actually came and stayed with his girlfriend, came and stayed. We were playing the Dutch at Lee Valley. Mm-hmm. And it was the same weekend as the finals weekend for netball at the Copper Box. Mm-hmm. So they went one day to the hockey. They went one day to the Copper Box. They said the Copper Box was unbelievable. They said it was absolutely amazing. Like, even if you're not a netball fan, it was amazing. Meanwhile, obviously, they came and watched the hockey. And my mate who loved the hockey was like, yeah, it was great. And his girlfriend was like, yeah, I didn't really feel it. I didn't really get it. And I'm like, yeah, I completely understand. I think there's just so much more we can do on the... Whilst we can also increase the exposure, I think there's also so much we can do on the day to make sure the fans' experience is like as the highest possible point it can be. I think we can learn a lot from other sports that have made that jump, whether it's rugby, who've gone from, granted, they might have gone a bit too quick, but from that amateur to semi-professional. I don't necessarily think that in terms of where hockey needs to go, but what it does need to do is learn from those sports of how to do it and how not to do it. Mm-hmm. I think the more we can gain experience from those sports to kind of see, right, what have netball done that's worked really, really well? What's rugby done that's worked really, really well? What's League Two football done that actually goes really well? Like, I think that's, for us, it's not necessarily a big jump to kind of, we're going to go all in. I think it's a case of what can we do each stage to kind of increase it? Whether that's covered seating at grounds, that means fans can actually watch the game without getting absolutely soaked wet through in a country that throws it down. Majority of the year, like it's stuff like that that I think we can be a lot cleverer with, to basically increase the fans' experience. Then they actually stick around, rather than, oh, it's raining, we'll go inside. So the game's just carrying on, and there's five people there with raincoats and umbrellas, and that's it. So I think from that point of view, I think quality of exposure, but also fans' experience. I think there's two big things that we can kind of push.
Sportspiel is proud to be partners with the Mintridge Foundation, founded in 2015 by Managing Director Alex Wallace. The charity is dedicated to enhancing life skills in young people through sport. They provide a support network for young people by harnessing the power of sporting role models and have several wonderful ambassadors, many of whom have been guests on this show. The Mintridge Foundation assists young people of all ages, abilities and physical capabilities to develop confidence and resilience and create awareness of the importance of mental and physical well-being through sport. Another wonderful example of just how powerful sport can be to everyone. To find out more, go to mintridgefoundation.org.uk or you can find a link in the episode show notes.
We'll turn it to sort of some of what you suggested. Last summer was a fairly unique one in terms of a home Commonwealth Games all broadcast on the BBC. I know there were a couple of clips from, especially from the men's hockey team, that went viral. One positively was one of Phil Roper's goals. The other one was of Chris Griffith's red card incident. Maybe not so positive for the sport, but hockey was getting that exposure. You could watch it for free. And I guess the crowds are some of the biggest you probably played in at home. How was that? I know your tournament ended unfortunately early, but how was that experience for you?
Yeah, I mean, it's no contest in terms of that side of things. I think they were really clever with how they set it up. The whole like atmosphere was amazing because it was just a wall. It was a wall of people. So the noise just carries. The problem with, if we're looking at Lee Valley from a problem point of view, is we've got one stand that's covered. So the noise carries from one little bit, but it's also the one that's least populated. And then you just lose the noise quite quickly. Whereas with like the way it works in Edgbaston was kind of all the sound just hit you like a wall. And it's exactly what we've been talking about. Games are on BBC. Oh, wicked. Cool. So I'm getting people that have never really watched hockey messaging me being like, this is amazing. Like, can we get tickets? And I'm like, yeah, you can. Then they see the price and they go, probably not. Because it's cost to get down there and this, that, the other, whereas also central location. So suddenly, people who don't even know about hockey were going to the games because they got tickets in the ballot and that kind of stuff. I think it's such a clever way to do it. Because then suddenly, there was not one. I think we were one of the most watched sports in terms of people in the stands. I remember going down in the morning. We went down one morning just to go and watch some of the hockey and it was packed. I think it was like Ghana versus. Who were they playing? I can't remember who they were playing, but it was like we went down and it was just rammed. Like, ridiculously cool. Like, that for me, like, if you're looking at, like, Lee Valley for Women's World Cup, it wasn't rammed for the smaller games, whereas you can fill a stadium quite happily at a Commonwealth Games with people that don't necessarily know about it, but it's also because the tickets were so affordable. So then you're looking at, like, the conflict and this, that, and the other, but yeah, amazing. Unbelievable. Genuinely unbelievable. Also, it's a more northern crowd, so I got on one more with it. My parents are locals, so it was kind of like, it was really cool to see people from Leeds, Manchester, Liverpool, Sheffield, like that kind of northern clientele that don't normally go to Lee Valley because it's so far, two, it's costly. Actually really nice to see them come down on the train and kind of walk from the train straight to a stadium, come in, have an amazing time and get home as well for tea. That stuff is really cool, whereas if you come and watch Lee Valley, you might have to stay for an extra bit of time. So it's just a bit of... Yeah, so it's just making sure that kind of like we keep giving people the opportunity to come and watch the games because it makes such a difference, especially live.
When you're in a crowd that big, but there's also, I think, like you say, maybe a lot of people that don't know hockey, is there a different vibe in the crowd? Does it feel different or is it...
Partisan, mate. It's partisan. It's 100% more hostile. And that's kind of what... I remember we played the first games of Pro League, so this would have been
2019,
yeah, and it was Spain away. I think we won 6-5 that day.
One of the best games of hockey.
It was absolute carnage, and I remember turning up, and we were warming up, and there were kids giving us the Vs. They were about 8 or 9 years old, and they were giving us the full two fingers, and I was like, oh, right, okay, this is hostile. It was an unbelievable experience, but it's that kind of like home advantage. It felt like a home advantage. Lee Valley doesn't necessarily feel like a home advantage because we've got a home crowd. It's great having a crowd, but it feels quite a neutral crowd. Whereas like, Birmingham was not neutral in one way whatsoever. Like, it was very much, there was genuine boos, which we don't hear very often, but it's what makes such an amazing atmosphere is the fact that it's a hostile crowd, and it does make a difference. And I think also having cheaper alcohol alongside it helps in terms of that. But it genuinely felt like, in the games, you felt like you had that 12th man, and that's what you want in home games, naturally. So yeah, like, especially the Aussie game, like, it was fully, I think it was a small crop of Aussie fans and the rest were all supporting England, and it was genuinely, like, ridiculous, the noise.
That was also one hell of a game, and it was a controversial game. There were a
couple
controversial decisions in that, and I guess, yeah, again, you know, that England team probably on the day, you could have said deserved to win, and how, again, disappointing was it to not quite reach the final?
Yeah, I mean, we've still not made it as a men's side in the Commies. We've not made it to the final. So I think from that point of view, we felt it was an amazing opportunity to do so. And again, the boys left it all out there. It just wasn't to be. It's again, just making sure we learn the lessons to make sure that if we get that opportunity again, we'll take it. And I think what's really nice is what's really cool is the fact that we're not the group that kind of like holds on in games. We're now the group that kind of takes the ascendancy and kind of really pushes. And I think it's a mind shift since Revs has come in. It's kind of, what group are we? Are we a group that's going to absorb, or are we a group that's going to make the first punch? And it's really cool to see that we're the group that's taking the first punch. So it is going to be a learning curve, because it's changing from that classic British bulldog mentality of, well, we're just going to fight and we're going to fight and we're going to fight. It's now being like, no, we're going to dominate. And I think that's a different mindset and one that we're trying to get to, and I don't necessarily think we were there in the summer. I think we're getting there now in terms of this winter. Like, whilst it's frustrating, I think we're still on that path, and it's not a case of, oh well, we've not made it. It's now a case of the next stage. So what's the next thing? Right, Euros. Okay, we've got the whole Pro League to batter it through. We welcome the Scottish and Welsh boys back, and kind of that GB group now is a really tight knit unit where we can keep pushing. Mm-hmm. I think that's the real cool thing. And naturally, Euros, we split again for England, Wales and Scotland, but it's just for one tournament. I think that's quite a healthy place to be again, in the fact that we only split for one tournament and then we're back, so it's not necessarily too much of a break away from each other pushing towards Paris.
You've been a part of the programme for 5.5 years now, I believe.
7 years.
7 years.
Yeah, well, technically eight, but seven. We'll play seven.
How do you think things have changed, in just in terms of, as you mentioned, mindset and just like the dynamics, and just, yeah, what changes have you noticed have occurred in your period in that centralised programme? Obviously, a lot of personnel changes as well.
But yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of staff changes. There's been a lot of player changes. What's interesting is coming from a youngster coming in, or a younger player coming into the programme, to now being one of the older players with younger guys coming in. What's really pleasing to see is the fact that the younger guys coming in. So in 2016, there was quite a big shift in terms of team culture and kind of like driving a bit more support for each other rather than high challenge. We felt there was a lot of challenge, and the guys felt there was a lot of high challenge in the previous cycle, so from 2013 to 2016, without really much support. And there was a big push for the high support bit. So for the Tokyo cycle, a lot of it was on support and not necessarily as much challenge. There was still challenge, wasn't necessarily as much. And what actually the shift has come since Tokyo is the fact that we feel we've got that high support. It's now a high challenge, high support environment. And that's the big thing, is kind of just making sure that we push each other as much as we can, because this is now a group that wants to go and win things. I'm not saying it didn't before, but it's now a group that's probably more equipped to now go and win things. And I think that's where it's been quite cool to see the transformation. Whilst being in it, it's also been really cool to kind of step away and also see the transformation that the group's gone through. So it's quite a lot of a psychological shift as a group, but that's mostly down to the work that Katie, our psych, Rev's head coach now, Zach, interim head coach, has done. Danny, to some extent, in terms of getting the group through that initial phase. So I think it's like, it's a group that feels equipped, and there's the multiple different people have had impacts on that route, and I think that's what's been quite cool about it all. It's not necessarily down to one person, it's down to multiple different drivers. I think that's a really healthy place to be.
You mentioned Katie Warriner, or Katie Mobile, she's now known, your psychologist, someone I've been inspired by to sort of wanting to go into my career in psychology. And I know a lot of the guys have spoken so positive about the impact she's had. I just guess, yeah, from your perspective, how important has she been for you as a person and as an athlete?
Oh, massively. I used to have a real confidence issue. I used to have quite a lot of insecurities. Don't get me wrong, I still do, but they're a lot more in the open. And that's thanks to Katie. She's kind of, she's put in a lot of work individually. And I think credit to her is the fact that she's fully in. She can't do things half-assed. It's not her. And that's the beauty of Katie, is the fact that whether you like her or you don't like her, and whether you think she's great psych or she's not, if you commit and she commits, you're going to get somewhere pretty cool. And the work she's done with the group has been massive, monumental for some individuals, maybe less for others. But I think the big thing is kind of everyone's appreciated how much work she's actually done. And kind of, again, if you take a step back and you look at the individuals that she's worked with who are still in the program and guys who have left, you realise how much of an impact she's actually made. And kind of, I think that's quite impressive for a psych from an individual point of view, but also a team point of view. Is kind of, she's also worked in in an environment also now where she's probably not as comfortable. But again, she's gone away to kind of learn how to be more comfortable and kind of cracked on it. I think that, again, like at the end of the day, you have to shift for the group or you're not right for the group. And I think what's really cool is the fact that she's gone, okay, well, I need to be this person, so I need to step into this space. So I'm going to go and learn the skills to be able to step into that space. And I think that's where, you kind of appreciate how much work she puts in for the group, whether it's full-time or part-time, her role, the effort that she's putting in, you can only admire and you can kind of get on board with. Mm-hmm. So from that point of view, like, for the group, massive, but for me as an individual as well, huge. Absolutely huge.
How did you find it? You mentioned up there previously that maybe you weren't as open. How did you find initially sort of working with Katie, and then sort of, how did your mindset change as a result of her? And how long did that take?
Oh, awful. I was awful. I was like, I remember when we sat down and we properly talked about everything. We were in Cooper's, a coffee shop down the road, and we started talking, and I was very resistant to open up, because I was like, Katie, I'm not doing this. Anyway, about 10 minutes later, I'm in floods of tears in this coffee shop, and there's people looking at me. And Katie's just looking at me grinning, and I'm like, I'm bawling eyes out, and I'm thinking, this must look so weird to like people on the outside, like it must look really odd. So I was massively resistant for about 6 months, and then I was like, do you know what, sack it, let's crack on. So I'd worked with psychologists before, and I didn't really understand what they were getting at. They didn't understand me. It was a bit of like, ugh, let's not bother, I'll just crack on, I'll be fine. Whereas Katie's the first person that's properly sat down and gone, right, let's get to know you. Let's actually properly get to know you. So from that point of view, like, I was massively resistant. But over the course of, we're now 4 years now working together. I think she came in just before the World Cup. Before the World Cup? Yeah, so 4 years. Like, we're now at the point, so again, I had the conversation with her over in India. We were having a chat about everything, because obviously it's not the ideal scenario for myself. We were having the chat, and she's kind of like, where we're at is the fact that I can openly tell her exactly what's going on. So I can say, look, I'm not in a good place. I'm massively angry. She's like, well, it's not healthy. I'm like, yeah, it's not healthy, but this is where we're at. She's like, okay, well, what can we do about it? And this, that, and the other. And you automatically, you don't waste time going, oh, yeah, I'm fine, this, that, and the other. It's like, no, I'm not okay. What are we going to do about it? And that's the bit that kind of like, when you get to that point, it's quite a wonderful place to be, because you don't necessarily get stuck in your own head. You kind of just get it out and it's done. And then you crack on and you work out, right, okay, how can we change it, this, that, and the other. But for the first 6 to 9 months, I was absolutely useless. I couldn't, like, work it all out. And then for 3 months afterwards, I kind of thought, when you speak to somebody and you open up, it just you find answers. For about 3 months, my head was scrambled, because I'd got all my stuff out, and I had no idea what I was going to do with it, and no idea where we were going to go with it. And Katie didn't give me anything either. So I was like, right, okay, cool. I was like, this is the classic psych trick of the person works it out. And I was like, crap, here we go, right. But it was like, it was tough for those 3 months, because I was genuinely all over the place. I couldn't, like, I turn up to Bisham and I don't even know that I'd driven to Bisham. It takes me an hour. And I didn't even know. I was living in London at the time. And it's like, because my head was just constantly going through these thoughts, and then you realise you've gone through a week and you've not really done anything ambition because your head's still scrambled, and it's kind of, it's a really interesting like place to get to again, like where you, where you're constantly thinking you've got it all out, but you don't necessarily know what the route is to get to a place where you're a lot more comfortable with yourself. And that was the, and that, that eventually turned out to be the ultimate goal, was, well, how do you get to a point where you're comfortable with yourself? And yeah, we're 4 years down the line and I'm nearly there. Definitely much more there than I was, but it is, it's a really healthy place to be when you're able to talk about that bit. And it just took me, naturally it takes people a while.
How is it, how important is it as an athlete to even just begin to understand yourself and your strengths and weaknesses as a person, as an athlete? How important is that for growth and for developing?
Oh, huge. I think, like, I remember speaking to one of the guys about it the other day. It was kind of like, if I picked up and walked away from hockey, I feel I've now got all the skills that I want to, in terms of to be able to go away and do a normal job. Whereas if you'd have said that to me 5 years ago, when I was about 2 years into program, I wouldn't have a clue. I wouldn't know what my strengths were. I wouldn't know what my weaknesses were. I wouldn't feel comfortable in the working environment. I wouldn't have a clue what job I'd want to go to anyway. I think that kind of like the appreciation is the fact that we go through so much growth work, and we go through so much, well, how am I going to get better at this, that, and the other? Like, well, what am I actually really good at? We do that on a daily basis. So then to go into like a normal environment now, I'm like, well, I've done it for years in a highly pressurized environment where I've got somebody constantly looking at me, so I have to perform day in, day out. To go to another job where I've got 5 days to complete a project or 20 days to complete a project, like, it's a completely different mindset, but actually it's pretty similar in terms of the skills and things that you're using. So from that point of view, like, it's so important what we do day to day, because at the end of the day, if you want, you're in this to be the best player that you can be. And if you can win stuff along the way, great. That's what we want. If you don't win stuff along the way, okay, but are you going to be, the classic saying, isn't it, that are you enough with the medal than without it? Like, it's that kind of motto of like, okay, well, if I'm pushing myself every day, we're in a good place. Well, how do you do that? Well, you've got to look at the growth side of things. You've got to look at what you're good at, what you're bad at. How am I going to get better at the stuff I'm bad at? How am I going to make the strengths super strengths? And it's that kind of mindset that is the driver consistently.
Something I think you sort of already touched on in both of those previous answers, but again, sort of delving quite deep and personal here, what do you think have been the biggest changes in you as a person from when you first joined the program to where you are now?
I think how I deal with mistakes is a big one. I'm a massive perfectionist, but I used to let it ruin my game as well. So if I made 10 passes in a game and one of them was bad, I'd remember the one. I'd never remember the 9 good stuff. Whereas now I'm kind of a lot more appreciative of the fact that, all right, well, I might make one bad pass, but what's my reaction to the one bad pass? So I'm trying to mitigate the mistake as much as possible. So I don't necessarily let it affect me as much. And kind of like, I think my like shift through, kind of, I've just relaxed a lot more. I used to be quite an emotional bloke, still quite emotional now. But again, I like try to control it a lot more, so I don't let it affect me as much, so I'm not as erratic as I used to be. And that's with mouth or on the ball. Like, it's those kinds of things that I've tried to just be a lot more calmer, to try and, like, again, thanks to Katie, like, try and get as much out of people as possible. Funnily enough, like, I've started doing a psychology undergrad from the stuff that I've, basically because of the stuff that I've done throughout this program, because I find it fascinating working with people and trying to maximize what I have with people and how we get the most out of each other and this, that, and the other. I think that's one of the things that's actually, like, again, driven me as a player to kind of make sure that if I don't go to another tournament, okay, but I can still influence what we're doing and where we're going and how we're going about it. And I think that's the big thing for me, is kind of just making sure that I have a bit of a legacy. And it's not necessarily I want to have a legacy, it's a case of I want people to enjoy being around me and kind of make the most out of themselves. And that for me is like a big driver now, whereas if you asked me 7 years ago, that wouldn't have been a driver. And I think that's one, down to probably Katie. Two, probably Barry. Because Barry, I remember Barry speaking a lot about, he was like, what, I remember someone asked him, like, what do you want to be remembered for? And he was like, I want to be remembered for my legacy of what I brought, and what I brought was myself day to day. And I think that kind of like, you have to, again, you have to just appreciate he did that, he lived it. And it's just making sure that I don't miss an opportunity to be myself on those kinds of things and bring the best that I can to then bring the best out of others. I think that's probably a big thing for me.
So me and you are going to be fighting for jobs in the future then, if you're doing a psychology undergrad?
Funnily enough, I want to apply. I don't want to necessarily go into the world of psychology, but I want to use it as an applied scenario. So I'd love to go inside of the sports business or team like leader side of things, in terms of in that world and in the big city, and kind of just be able to apply knowledge rather than necessarily be a psych. Whilst I know I'd enjoy it, I'd also find it really taxing, because having been there as a player, I find to try and compartmentalise would be something that I'd need to learn before going anywhere near that world. And I don't necessarily think I've got the emotional intelligence for it at the moment. Maybe in 10, 15 years, who knows? Might find ourselves as colleagues. But I think like what I've really enjoyed is the fact that learning about it all has been really cool. And previously I've been so resistant to it, whereas now I'm incredibly open to it. Really interesting, just from that like team culture side of things.
Make sure you follow Sportspiel on social media. Search for Sportspiel Pod on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or on LinkedIn.
Going to a slightly different topic now, and again, another broad question, but why hockey? What was it about hockey that made you choose it?
Tough that. I loved football. I was a football kid. We had loads of when my parents moved to Manchester, by chance, we moved into a football neighbourhood, which we didn't know about. Prices, this, that, and the other, like obviously, like shot up when people realised that football was around. So we had like all United footballers around. I think Javier Hernandez was my next door neighbour at one stage. Like madness in terms of that side of things. So I was a massive football kid, and my parents just took me down, because my parents were all hockey. So they took me down to my sister's. I think my sister's game on the weekend, Saturday morning school hockey. So we're state grammars, both state grammars, myself and my sisters. So from that point of view, like, I just fell in love with the people that I played hockey with, and the guys that I grew up with, I still speak to, and when I can, I see them. I spent a lot of time with them. It was the classic like Saturday, you probably play school rugby in the morning, play till about 11, and you just get dropped at the club. That was it for the day, till 8 p.m. Because parents are running around, this, that, and the other, like sisters are playing elsewhere, parents are playing elsewhere. My mates were all playing in the same teams that I was. They weren't necessarily schoolmates. There was one or two schoolmates that played, but also like people that have now gone on to do some crazy things in terms of where they've ended up. We still have the connection through hockey, which I think is really cool. And quite a unique thing about hockey is the fact that because it's not like football where you play the game and you go home, hockey's a place where you spend time at the club and you kind of socialise and you meet guys and you kind of meet people through that way, and that set off the fascination for me of people. I'm so happy I chose it. Don't get me wrong, the finance side of it is not exactly pretty, but at the same time, like, what I will never underestimate is the power of meeting people and kind of connecting with people from that point of view. It's 100% the people for me, hockey.
And just on that line, are there any particular memories, seasons, matches that really stand out as being, you know, really special to you because of either, you know, what happened on the pitch or just the people that you were playing with?
My second year of uni, I've never had a better season in terms of results. But that season also with my season away in Hamburg. Those two seasons were kind of years where we basically overachieved with a side that we probably shouldn't have done as well with. And like that for me is a testament to how close the group was. Like both sides, like everyone lived within 15 minutes of each other. So you saw each other a lot. Uni, I think it's a lot easier because naturally you all live in the same city and like life becomes easy. Like it's set there for that reason. whereas the Hamburg stuff was kind of a similar point, but just by chance. And I think that kind of like the love of wanting to spend time around each other, but also like it not being too much. So kind of you had your own space if you wanted it, but also if you wanted to go see people, you could see people. Those years were crazy, whether it was like weekends away, this, that, and the other. Like there's so many stories from both years that I genuinely hold so close to me, because it's just, it was so much fun, and it was fun whilst winning. And I think like if you can connect, if you can get that connection, I think it's pretty unique, because I don't think many people get to experience that. But it's also winning in terms of like, so the year I had in uni, we won Bucks, which on paper we should never have done. We won our league to get promoted to the Prem. There were a few red cards, there were a few yellows in that year. Like it was carnage, but it was a lot of fun. It was also my first full year of playing fullback, so it was my first year of learning everything. And then the year in Hamburg was again just a completely different experience of learning a language. There were about five of us spoke English as first language, so it was good fun on that side of things. Like everybody was just learning differently. Yeah, so it the year in Germany was like, I think that was what was amazing, was the fact that it was a different scenario, different culture, different language, with people that were like-minded. And I think that kind of makes a massive difference. So yeah, just both years were just unbelievable, unbelievable.
What about in the in terms of sort of later on in your career, in terms of domestic over in England and then playing for England and GB, what are the memories that really stand out for you as being pretty special?
Again, it's probably similar. It's kind of the experiences of it. So kind of the club stuff's really interesting, because it's like you take it seriously, but there's only so much you can take seriously of it. I think that's what I really struggle with at times, and now appreciate a bit more. Because there's not loads of money in it. It's not 45 grand. It's not like football pay salary. I think it's quite interesting to kind of like, I just really enjoy. I enjoy it now. Whereas previously I always wanted to win and I didn't necessarily enjoy it and this, that, and the other. Whereas now I'm a bit more like, I just want to really enjoy it. Yeah, I want to win, but also just want to I want to really enjoy it. Whereas the international stuff, I think the international stuff speaks for itself. I think it's, for me, like that first three tournaments that I played in, well, four tournaments actually, I guess World League was a kind of one. So like Aslan Shah, couldn't have asked for a better start as a group. Young group coming in, no one really expected anything of us, go on and win it. Pretty damn cool experience. Euros, we came in, again, bit of an underdog, third place, had a hell of a third, fourth game against Germany. They look at commies in Australia, like Gold Coast, again, are just an unbelievable experience of kind of, I mean, myself and James Gore were speaking about it the other day, like the whole tournament that we had out there, I don't think I could probably have a better experience in terms of like everything as a whole package. So we had a really, really close flat that was just a really good fun to be around. We went out and we played pretty good hockey, tough environment, tough conditions. The village was unbelievable, like all the other sports that's going on, everything's just kicking off around you. That for me is probably a massive highlight, was Commonwealth Games 2018. And then like the club stuff, like the big game that stands out for me was, I remember being 3-0 down to Wimbledon, getting back to 3-3, last minute corner, 3-3, went on shuffles, like carnage. But it's the stuff afterwards, so like everybody back in the bar, back at the club after the game, and you've got 50 people in the clubhouse. Like that for me is the stuff I remember probably more than the game itself, because it's just everybody, like you've gone through the experience, but not one person's gone, I'm going home. Everyone's gone, back to the club? Yeah, back to the club. And again, living around the corner 5 minutes away helps, but it's like, it's that kind of thing for me was always really, really key to have in a hockey club, because I think it makes such a difference, kind of having the people that like-minded just actually want to spend time together. So yeah, probably quite similar to Mayors Abroad almost.
It's interesting, and this is in no way a criticism, it's just interesting that sort of asking for your highlights and the idea of Tokyo and being an Olympian didn't even come up. It's just interesting then from your perspective, how was that experience for you? Because yeah, it wasn't the perfect Olympic experience because of COVID and everything, but yeah, just sort of wondering how that sits in your mind, that whole tournament.
Yeah, to be honest, I wouldn't say it was euphoric. I think if we'd have done better, I think I'd have probably held it a bit more high. I think it's a unique experience, but it's not necessarily one that I'd hoped my Olympic experience would have been. It's a tough one because I think like we played pretty well. We got a decent draw as well in terms of we had India in the quarters. We didn't really play that well in that game personally. But then like you look at the tournament and everyone's in masks. It's a bit limited in terms of what you can do. You couldn't leave. One of my big things was I always wanted to travel around Tokyo, and you couldn't leave the village. And then 2 days later, after you finished, you were kicked out of the village and sent home. It was a really odd, like, yeah, it's one that I don't necessarily. I still question whether I'm really an Olympian. I think that's just me as an individual rather than actually the experience. But I wouldn't necessarily say it was the highest thing for me because I wouldn't necessarily say it was a normal Olympics. I think compared to what Paris could be like, I think it'll probably feel quite small in comparison. But when you're playing in the biggest stage in front of zero people in the crowd, it's a really odd feel. In a country that, again, I'd have loved to have seen what the crowds would have been like, because the stadiums were phenomenal. Both pitch one and pitch two were both amazing. So it's a real shame that it wasn't. But at the same time, like, I think the other ones were my first experiences of. So whether it was playing abroad, whether it was like commies, whether it was Euros, like, again, playing in front of the Dutch in the semi-final in front of 10,000 people is like an incredible experience. Whereas playing in front of, yeah, it was an Olympics, but playing in front of zero people in an amazing stadium is not necessarily the same for me. It's not necessarily translated the same. So I think that's probably why it wasn't necessarily as high as what I hoped it to be. Because again, like the Olympics, it was unbelievable, but it was unbelievable in a different way. It's probably the best way I could describe it.
That's a refreshingly honest take on that, I think, because it's not something that many athletes, I don't think, have shared publicly, that sort of, yeah, how it was different. Going ahead to Paris then, does the idea in your mind that it could be, we've spoken about Commonwealth Games and how you've experienced both of those and essentially something similar in Paris, does that drive you to want to cement that place in the squad and make sure you're all selected for Paris?
Yeah, 100%. I think Paris could be phenomenal. But my driver isn't to be selected. My driver is to be the best I can be. And if I can get in that squad for then, brilliant. If I can't, that's my journey. I think the big thing for me is kind of, I don't just want to be selected and then stop. I think that's quite a dangerous place to be mentally when all you're caring about is just being selected. Like, for example, like I really struggle with people who just want to be there. So for example, like, people who just want to be in the GB squad, like they're just happy being in the GB squad. Like for me, that's not a thing. I really struggle with that mindset of like, it's a job. Well, it's not a job. Like if you're in this, you want to be the best that you can be, or you want to win stuff. Like I get that driver. I don't get the, oh, I'm just happy to be there type thing. So for me, like, it's probably why I don't hold Tokyo as highly as probably what other people do, is because we didn't win anything. So I don't necessarily, fifth is about as good as 60th. Like that for me in that mindset, or 14th or however many teams there were. I think like for me, that's the big thing. And like Paris is one, I want to go because I feel we've got a real opportunity to win something there. But two, to go to an Olympics in front of all the fans and everything else, yeah, it'd be an absolutely amazing spectacle. So for me, it's kind of, I want to make sure I'm there because I think we can win something. And I feel I can add something to that. And that was what was really tough about this World Cup, was it was the first time that I've properly sat down and gone, I can add something to this group, and I didn't get selected for it. So it's quite a bit of a kick in the old nutsack for me in terms of that kind of mindset of, okay, I still feel I can bring something to this group. I've now got to prove it. But that's not necessarily, that's me proving it to myself that no, I can. I just need to be better. And that's my driver at the moment to get me to a point come the summer where I'm going, I'm good. I'm bringing something to this group and we're going to go and win something. I think that's where I want to get to in the summer. And if I don't get there, I don't get there. But at least I'm setting my sights high to get there.
If you want the latest Sportspiel episodes and updates direct into your email inbox, then subscribe to our newsletter. You can find a link to do so in the show notes of this episode.
One final thing I wanted to chat to you about is something you do off the pitch.
Oh, God.
That is the Let's Stick Together podcast.
Yeah.
As with this episode is released, you'll be into your fourth season alongside Phil Roper and Newt the Mole. How did the idea of the podcast come about originally, and how has it gone in terms of sort of what you were expecting compared to where it is now?
Phil basically badgered me for about, I reckon, a year, being like, mate, there's nothing in this. There's nothing in this world that's like that, what we could do. And I was like, yeah, I just don't know if it's, I don't know if it's us. And I was like, what do you mean? It's 100% us. I was like, but I like the fact that us is private, not necessarily us publicly. And then eventually we bit the bullet and season one went okay and kind of, it didn't feel right, but we carried on because we were like, there's something, we're just not sure what it is. It turns out we needed a third permanent member. Lo and behold, Phil goes abroad for a year and he's like, I've got the perfect person for it. And I'm thinking, I'm not sure. Because I didn't know Youp that well at that point. And I think we'd met once or twice, but we didn't necessarily know each other that well. And then turns out Youp's English is better than ours. So I was like, okay, well, I'm in. Okay, we'll see how it goes. And since then, it's kind of skyrocketed for us. We just like giving a unique spin on elite sport or elite hockey from the point of view that no one really talks about. So we kind of just try to offer something a little bit different to what your standard podcast could be like, specifically in hockey as well, which is so middle class and people are so scared about what they say, whereas we've kind of tried to go the opposite way and just be like, look, we're just going to say it, and if we disagree, we disagree, but at least we're saying it. So yeah, it's kind of just taken off from there. Carnage.
I was going to say that is one of the defining features of the podcast is how honest it is, and both in different ways. Obviously, with the episode you did at the back end of Series 3 when Newt had found he'd not been selected for the World Cup was incredibly honest from him and his reflections on that. But then there's also the comments you make about like the FIH and things like that from a player perspective,
yeah,
which again is refreshingly honest. And what I wanted to ask is sometimes it feels like there's a bit of needle. Is that genuine needle, or is that just more playing up for the podcast?
What do you mean by needle?
As in, sometimes it feels as though you are genuinely winding each other up with some of the stuff you say and you're genuinely annoyed.
It's all genuine. I think that's what's really interesting is, we recorded on Thursday, and at different points, each one of us lost it in terms of our frustration towards the FIH. And what was really interesting was kind of, it wasn't set off by any of us. It was just that person talking passionately about what they believe. And that's what's really good fun about working with Ropes and Youp is the fact that like, you can poke the bear if you want to, but you don't necessarily need to because normally they've already poked themselves. And I think that's the really cool place is the fact that all three of us love the sport. We all three love hockey. Yeah, we might doss around, we might joke about it and this, that and the other, but we're all coming from a place where we've played this sport all our lives, we love playing it, we just want the best for it. And I think when you have that kind of like in the back of your mind and then you listen to the podcast, you go, yeah, I hear it. And yeah, there's a bit of moaning and there's a bit of whining and this, that and the other, but it's because we don't see it being treated with the same respect that we think it should be, especially at the elite level. And that's the bit that's frustrating at times. So, like, if we're looking from the World Cup perspective, there was an incident involving one of the German guys and one of our English guys, which should have been a red card, and the FIH bottled it. And for me, like, if you listen to the episode, you'll hear me go off, and the boys are, like, trying to calm me down, and I've just gone, because I'm like, I don't understand how it's not. And for me, like, a lot of the time, they don't answer to anybody. And that's what's really interesting. And yeah, they're the top governing body in this, that, and the other of the sport. And like, same with the FA in football, like, they don't necessarily answer to anyone. But I feel they should provide answers for certain things. And that's one of those things that they should provide answers for. Or, for example, how India got 2 junior World Cups and 2 senior World Cups for men's hockey in a row, but the women's wasn't there. Okay, well, one, give us an answer for the first bit about why the men's was, that they won it twice in a row when you're talking about giving the game to everybody. But then why wasn't the women's there? Because I'd love to hear that answer. And it's things like that that I'd love them just to be a little bit open about, which they're never going to be. But but it'd be really interesting to hear. So it's three of us basically talking passionately, and we do lose ourselves in the moment at times, and it is funny, but at the same time, there's a background noise of just a bit of seriousness, and that's what we're trying to, like, I think the more we go through the seasons, I think we'll probably get better and better at almost bringing out the jokiness of the serious side of it, and I think that's what we tried. That's what we tried to do. It's getting easier.
Do you think that's what sort of makes the podcast a success, though, and that you're willing to be honest and open in a way that, yeah, a lot of people not necessarily are in hockey?
I wouldn't say it's success.
It's doing pretty well.
Yeah, it's because it's middle class. It's a lot of people that scoff at things, and there's a lot of people that kind of like just let things go because it's tradition. And if we want hockey to grow, hockey's got to break tradition. It's got to break away from the classic public school boy, like this, that, private schools, like this, that, and the other. Like, the amount of people that moan about like private school kids being involved in the junior age group stuff, like that stuff for me is just a bit of nonsense. Like, if you want people to break in from state schools, they can do it. They've just got to go out and, yeah, they might not have the beauty of a pitch 2 minutes away from them. But the funny thing is if they learn how to deal with those scenarios and get over it, they're going to be more successful in the long run because they've learned more. So rather than having it handed to them, they're going to be more successful as athletes. That is the crux of it. But people constantly just moan about it. And for me, like, hockey needs to break that tradition of just moaning and just people actually going out and doing. And until we get to that point, I don't know if the sport's ever going to go anywhere, to be perfectly honest with you. Like, the funny thing is Youp is from... So Youp is a South boy. So South is equivalent to... South of Holland is equivalent to the North of England in terms of, like, working class, crack on, get on, this, that, and the other. So me and Phil are both Manchester-based. Well, I was South Manchester-based. Ropes was Chester-based. Like, we've both come from the North. So we know it's not perfect. We know it's not pretty. We just kind of, you just get on and graft, and you get whacked in a game, you don't moan about it, you get up. Yeah, you might moan a bit, but you get up, you crack on, because that's what it was, that's how you were raised. And it's like, it's funny that it's us three that have ended up doing a podcast. So when people like send in things that are like just a bit whiny, we're like, what are you doing? Like, don't care about that, that's not relevant. So it's really interesting. Like, I think hockey needs it. I think hockey needs like a different approach to what it's been doing previously, because I don't necessarily think it's broken through. I think they also need characters. And whilst I don't necessarily think we're the perfect characters, we are characters in our own right. And I think the other thing is, because we're not perfect and we never say we're perfect, we're able to kind of have an opinion. And most of it's positive opinion about others. Yeah, there's some that's like not necessarily as positive, but it's not out of anything other than, again, just passion for the sport and kind of what we believe. And that's where I think we've struck a real chord with people that do listen. And as podcasts go, we're doing pretty well. It's not horrendous, the numbers, as much as Phil wants it to be all the time. But at the same time, like, could we go in a different direction? For sure. And I think we'll get to a point where we've got to decide what we're going to do with it. But at the moment, it's working really well, which is nice.
How does it feel when people come up to you and want to talk to you, not just about you as a professional athlete, but about your podcast, and so you get people that are listening and wanting to talk to you about it? How does that make you feel when that happens?
It's tough. It's tough when people ask after a game, like, about the podcast, and they don't really care how you played. That's tough, that is, because then you know you've not played that well. It's awesome. It's really cool. So I remember when we played the Dutch at home, somebody came with three print-offs of the FIFA cards that we gave each other and had to sign it. And I was like, that is ridiculous. Like, the fact that there's people that are like, and people who have clearly heard me swear and probably shouldn't be hearing that I'm swearing, is really cool. Because it's, again, it's like, I think what's nice is it's off our own back. I think what's really enjoyable is, like, I remember we were expecting at some point to be called in by England Hockey for it, me and Phil. But thankfully, we stay away from that topic a lot, so we don't necessarily get brought in. But we were waiting for it at one stage because we were like, because it's a different image of ourselves, we don't know whether that fits in with the ethos and this, that, and the other. But again, we're not trying to talk negatively about anything. We're just trying to promote a bit more and a bit more exposure. So I think from that point of view, like, it's really cool when you're finishing a game and people then want to talk to you and ask you things for the podcast. And like, Youp was the most popular one when we played against the Dutch. out of everybody that they wanted to see, Youp was the one out of the whole of the England men's and Dutch. And I was like, that's a cool place to be when you've got somebody that you don't necessarily see at all often being like a bit of centre of attention post game. And I think that's a really like unique place to be. And I don't think anyone in hockey will have probably had that, really, considering this is like the first proper one UK base that's kind of taken off a bit. So I think it's really odd, but awesome at the same time, just really odd.
And I guess final question from me, without wanting to give too much away, where would you like to see Let's Stick Together go in future series, future years?
I really would love, it's going to sound really odd, I really want like a league highlight show, and I'd love for us to be the ones that do it. Because I think there's something in it of just a 30-minute highlights package with two presenters. I think would actually be really cool. I think it's something that could be done quite easily if teams are willing to like create footage. I think it would actually just, I genuinely think it would just promote the sport. And I think people would watch it as well, because it's like 30 minutes. You can have it on in the background, basically a match of the day, but for hockey. I don't necessarily think that'd be too difficult to get on a live stream. Get us in the room together, two of us. We go through the footage quite easy. You just go on Huddle or whatever, and you can kind of like edit what you want to see and things like that. And I think like you can create a video quite easily from the game footage. And I think something like that, I think, would go a long way. And not like the Monday Night Hockey. I really struggle with like what is essentially the way it's publicised, because I think it's done really poorly. And I don't think that's their fault in terms of the people that are doing it. I think it's just, it can be done a lot better. I think it just requires basically a sponsor that can put in a bit of money so everybody has the same camera. And I think we're on to a winner. Either that, or we branch out into other sports. I know the boys want to do basketball and American football. They're both American-based in terms of their sporting interests. I'd love it just to get to season 10. I think that would be a cool place if you can get to season 10. I think we've done pretty well, considering we're at season 4 already. I think we're doing all right. And what, 12 episodes a season? 10 episodes a season? I couldn't even tell you. Yeah, so I think like if we can get to 100 episodes, I think that would be quite a unique place to be. But yeah, you never know. Phil might just pack it in at some point. You never know.
Thank you to Brendan for such an open, honest and thought-provoking interview. As someone who loves hockey myself, it really is fantastic that we have athletes like him willing to rip up the rulebook and try to grow the sport in a way that makes it appealing to everyone. We'll be back next week with another awesome guest, so if you haven't already done so, make sure you subscribe to us and get that episode sent straight to your device. You can also follow us on social media by searching for the handle at SportsWheelPod, while you can further sign up to our newsletter by clicking on the link in the show notes.